You know, the theme that was chosen for this year is the question of making it real. The big subject now in the Jewish world is really the subject of spiritual lack, or a lack of spiritual connection, spiritual experience, if you like. And I think if we study the period we're going through, take a look at the counting of the Omer, I think we can derive a message that I hope can make a difference in this area. Let me start by asking a few questions, perhaps may seem unrelated. And then we'll take a look at the counting of the Omer, and we'll see if we can use that idea to answer these questions and learn something deep. Here are a few questions. First question is this. When the prophet talks about the people of Sodom, the archetypal evil society, so bad that it needed to be wiped out completely, disappeared in a cataclysm of destruction. So we know that those people were indescribably evil. They were brutal. They the Midrashim say that if their philosophy was not to give anything, no charity, their philosophy was you need to earn your keep. Nothing should go out in an unearned direction. Somebody came seeking hospitality. The measure says if the person was too long, they cut his feet off so he fit the bed. If he was too short, they stretched him and tore him apart. Incredibly, incredibly brutal. Lot's daughter once, who lived there, gave a crust of bread to a poor person. They tied her down on the roof and smeared her with honey, let the bee sting her to death. Tremendously brutal. Immoral in every way. But when the prophet talks about the evil of the people of Sodom, he says the reason they were wiped out was because tachas asher she'olay hechzakta yedei oni ve'evyon, because they never supported the poor. They didn't give charity. And that is very peculiar. Again, we know that they were guilty of tremendous brutality and immorality. But when the Torah brands them, talks about the reason for their destruction, it does not talk about any of that immorality. It talks about the fact that they did not give charity. What's peculiar about that is that not giving charity is nowhere near as serious as all the tremendous evil that they generated. Not giving charity is the negation of a positive commandment. The punishment for not giving, for not fulfilling positive commandments, is much less severe than the punishment for breaking negative commandments. So why, when you target and you identify the reason for their destruction, do you talk about not giving charity? Apart from which, not giving charity is not a capital offense in Judaism. It doesn't come near that area. That's one strange question. Here's another question. The Midrashim, the Gaon of Vilna, brings that when a person dies, three angels come to greet you. Three angels. Person moves down a channel towards family members. A lot of rich description of this transition. But one of the features of that transition, leaving this world and moving into another one, is that three angelic beings come to greet you. One comes to add up all your mitzvahs. One comes to add up all your averus, your transgressions. And the third one comes to see who are you. What's called Hechan Torosei V'imish Shlema B'yoda. Where's your Torah? And is it complete in your hand? If you're a man, primarily it's one's Torah learning. If you're a woman, primarily it's one's Torah practice in the world. Torah's chesed, how you make a difference in the world. And what's needed here, what's peculiar about this is, why do you need three angels? You know, anyone who knows anything about accounting knows that once you have the credits and the debits, you have the total. If you put all the credits, and there's nothing neutral in Jewish thought, that means every activity you do is either positive or negative. Even if you're simply doing nothing, that's not neutral. Doing nothing, if you need the time, is classed in mitzvah activity. You need the time off. Doing nothing when you should be doing something positive is a negative use of the time. We don't have any neutral activity. And therefore, all actions of one's life can be called credits or debits. So if you add up all the credits and all the debits, why is a third angel necessary to see what the total is, so to speak? It doesn't make any sense. By the way, the Gaon says something very, very amazing. Very moving. And if this doesn't move you, there's basically no hope for you. The Gaon says that angel, you know, the Medrash says, the Gemara says that when a person's not yet born, the unborn fetus developing in the mother's womb, he's taught the whole Torah. He has an angel, teaches him the whole Torah. With that, he sees from one end of the world to the other. He knows his own future, his own destiny. And at the point of birth, he gets a blow. The angel gives him a blow on the mouth, and he forgets everything that he knew. If you'd like some homework, you can think about, why is it a blow on the mouth? It's not tonight's subject, but surely to make someone forget something, you give them a blow on the head. Anyway, be that as it may. He gets a sharp blow on the mouth. The shock makes him forget all the Torah that he knew, and he's born as a simple child who knows nothing. The Gaon says that when you leave this world and you move into the next, and these three angels come to greet you, the third one, the one who comes to see what you've amounted to in total, as he approaches you, you recognize his face. He turns out to be the one who learned Torah with you in the womb before you were born. And at the end of your life, he's come back to see, did you do it? That perfection that you had for free, where you resonated with all the cosmic wisdom, and then you lost it in that painful moment before birth. And then I left you in the world to fight for it yourself and to make it your own and to achieve it through your own effort. Did you do it? That's the angel. But the question we must deal with this evening is, why do you need a third angel if you have already all the credits and debits? That's another question. Here's the third one. Again, you know, this is serious stuff. We're talking about this world, the next, the purpose of life, the assessment that will be made when a person leaves this world. So here's another question about that. And once we're scaring ourselves, we might as well terrify ourselves. So here's another question along those lines. The Gemara says that when a person dies, you get asked certain questions. 5 or 6 questions you get asked. The questions are, did you deal honestly, which has 2 interpretations. Does it mean business activities? Or does it mean, did you deal with intensity and faithfulness in your learning? The give and take. Does it mean the give and take of business activities? Does it mean the give and take of spiritual activities? But you get asked that question. Did you learn Torah? Did you learn Torah? Did you fix time for Torah learning? Other questions as well. Did you try to get married and have children? Various questions you get asked. But there's a peculiar sequence of events in response to the answers you give. One says like this. Let's say you get asked that question, why did you not engage Torah more in the world? What will you say? Now, let's remember, this is a world of truth. There's no saying things that are false or being devious. One's incapable of being devious in that world. All the facade and illusion has been stripped away. So what will you answer? Perhaps you'll say you were too poor. You were too poor? That's a legitimate excuse. If you were not given riches or sufficient for your needs in this world, you have to make an effort. There's no question about that. You have to make an effort. You're studless. You have to close the books. You have to go out and earn a living. So let's say you were not a wealthy person and you needed to work hard to support your family. So when you get asked in the spiritual world, God says to you, Hashem says to you, why did you not learn more Torah? And you say, Hashem, you never gave me enough to sustain myself and you forced me to go out to work. Perfectly legitimate answer. The problem is the Gemara says it will not be accepted. That answer will not be accepted. Because they will say to you, were you as poor as Hillel? The phrase that's used is Hillel Mechayev Anim. Hillel is the one who obligates the poor. If you say, I couldn't afford to make a living, I couldn't afford to study more, and therefore I had to put a lot of effort into making a living, they'll say, Hillel was poorer than you, and he managed. What's the story? Hillel was a very, very poor individual in the time of the early Mishnaic period. He was a woodcutter. And the Chazal say that, the Gemara says that on one occasion when he came to the study hall, to the yeshiva, the custom in those days was you paid a few pennies to enter. On one occasion he didn't have the few pennies. His woodcutting had not yielded even the few pennies that he needed to enter. So on that particular occasion, he couldn't enter the yeshiva, so he climbed on the roof and he lay on the skylight and he put his ear to the skylight to hear the discussion of the great sages of his day, Shmaya and Avtalion. It was a freezing night, the snow was falling. The next morning when they began the lessons in the yeshiva, the room was dark. They looked up at the skylight, they saw the shadow of a frozen man. They brought him down into the yeshiva, thawed him, and they saved his life. And that's the story. Incidentally, among all the other questions here, why did he risk his life to learn Torah? There's no obligation to risk your life to learn Torah. There's no question about it. Your life, preserving your life, comes first. Why did he risk his life to learn Torah? But perhaps a more perplexing question is this. He lay down in the snow to learn Torah because he couldn't afford the few pennies to enter, which is an absolutely extreme response to that situation. So when you say you didn't learn more Torah because you had to make a living, they'll say that's not an acceptable answer because he was poorer than you and he decided he did it anyway, at risk to his life. By the way, if you think you'll get away with saying you were too rich, the Gemara says that won't work either. Because if you say you were too rich, you know there's a Jewish obligation to take care of your assets and your investments. There's even one of the Talmudic sages who says that I'm not as great as my father because he used to assess his possessions twice a day and I do it once a day, which means that there's a clear obligation to take care of your possessions and your assets and handle them responsibly. So if you say, Hashem, you gave me a lot of wealth, that's a position of responsibility, and I used my wealth, took a lot of time and I administered it and I used it well, took time, they will say that's not an acceptable answer. Why? Because there was a man called Rabbi Elazar ben Chosum who was fabulously wealthy, and he didn't do it that way. The Gemara says he owned shipping companies and cities, many estates. He left them all in the hands of managers, and he wandered the roads from one yeshiva to another to gain all the wisdom that he could from various methods of learning. No doubt he first acquired his own unique approach to learning, but when he was self-sufficient, he put a little pack on his back, and he wandered the roads from one place to another to pick up all the Torah wisdom that he could, and all his assets and possessions and investments he left in the hands of managers. The Talmud says in one place that he was actually arrested in one of his own estates, because the manager who arrested him didn't know that he was his boss. Why? Because he had nothing to do with him. Because he paid no personal attention to his own finances. So here you have a situation where you get asked a question at that critical phase of beginning an existence in the next world, and you quote the book, you say, look, Hashem, it says in your Torah that if I am too poor and I have to make a living, that's what I ought to do. And you quote the law, and they say, no, that's not acceptable, because there was somebody who lived to a higher standard. And if you say, I was too poor, I was too rich, and I behaved responsibly, and I took care of all my assets, they will say, well, there was someone richer than you, and he didn't live to that standard, he lived to a higher standard. And what's peculiar here is that in any court of law, all you have to do is justify your actions in terms of the law. Imagine going to an American court, and they accuse you of some misdemeanor, and you show that you've fulfilled the letter of the law exactly. Case is closed. What judge in his right mind would say to you, well, that's the law, but we expect more of you? That's a moral claim, that's a tremendously religious, but that's not a legal claim. And therefore, when you go through the process called din, the process called judgment, what is the Talmud telling us here? Hashem sets a certain standard. He writes in his Torah that you have obligations to make a living and to take care of your assets. And when you fulfill those fully, they said, that's not good enough. There were people who did better, who went beyond, extremely beyond the letter of the law. That's very peculiar. So those are some questions that I'd like to begin with. Let's spend a few minutes looking at the question of the Omer. I think if we understand it deeply, we might derive a new principle that will help us answer those questions, and I hope take us beyond that as well. The counting of the Omer, which I'm sure I don't have to tell you, is the process of counting the days of the 7 weeks that we're going through, from Pesach to Shavuos, Pesach to Shavuot. Those are the weeks we're going through now. The mitzvah is to count the days. Let's ask a few questions about that mitzvah. And I think when you examine it closely, you find it's a very peculiar thing. The mitzvah is to count the days, the beginning of each day. When night falls, we count the day, the number of weeks, and we count 7 times 7 days. But there's some very strange features of that mitzvah. The first is we don't count the first day. The mitzvah is to begin the count from the second day of Pesach, not from the first day. Why? There's no question that the concept is moving from Pesach to Shavuot. Why don't we count the first day if that's where the process begins? We count the second day. And just as strange, we don't count the last day. We count 49 days, even though the Torah says count 50. The language in the Torah is Tisperu Chamishim Yom, count 50 days. We count 49. The 50th day, which is Shavuos, we wait for nightfall, we make Kiddush, and Shavuot. If the Torah says count 50, how come we don't count the 50th? You know, we take very seriously and literally every nuance of Torah. And here's a clear, explicit instruction, count 50 days, we count 49. That's another peculiarity. But there's more. Counting the Omer is very clearly a process of a countdown towards a longed-for occasion. You know, the Midrashim say that leaving Egypt was like a moment of birth, just like the shepherd puts his hand inside the animal and helps her give birth to the calf. So Hashem put his hand into the contamination of Egypt and gave birth to the Jewish people. And there's no question that it's an immature situation of birth, and 7 weeks later, a situation of marriage, where we are fully mature, we meet Hashem in an intimate relationship. The phrase is that he should kiss us with the kisses of his mouth. You're talking here about a development from a childlike or undeveloped animal reality to a human and transcendent level. You know, it's very clear that the Omer is an offering brought on the second day of Pesach, and it's an offering of barley. Barley is animal food. Throughout the Torah, barley is regarded as a very coarse and rough animal food. The food that's offered on Shavuot is fine, refined flour, 13 times sifted and refined flour. No one feeds that to animals. And the meaning is there's a process of growth here from the animal to the human. You begin at the animal level. The Gemara says in one place that a woman who secludes herself improperly with a man other than her husband, the offering she brings is barley. is an animal activity, and she brings an animal food for her offering. So we're talking here about the Pesach situation where we are undeveloped. We are taken out, as it were, Hashem takes us out of Egypt. We have done no work or development on ourselves. And 7 weeks later, we reach a transcendent level, we can receive the Torah. So the problem is this. If you're moving towards an event that you long for, we should be counting down, not up. You know, when they blast off for the moon, it goes 10, 9, 8, 7. You count backwards. You count down how many days are left. When you move towards a longed for experience, someone's getting married in a few weeks' time. You don't count the days that have gone by. That's irrelevant. You count the days that are left. You count down. You remember the last few weeks of your school career? Remember that? You counted down the days. Nobody counted the days that had gone by. That is too awful to think of. You know. You counted the days that were left. There's only 19, 18, 17. That's how we do things. And therefore, when we're counting down to Shavuos, we're looking forward to the receiving of the Torah. How can we relate to the days that have gone by? And if you guys think that's a mistake or an accident, we call it the counting of the Omer. We call it Sfirat HaOmer. The Omer is the offering that was brought at Pesach. Why don't we call it the offering of Shavuos? Every journey is named for its destination. You never name a journey for the point of departure. That's irrelevant. I mean, it's important. You need to know where to catch the train or get on the plane. But you name a journey for its destination, right? This is the St. Louis flight or train, whatever it is, because that's where you're going. If we're moving towards Shavuos, we should be naming the journey for the point of destination, not the point of departure. Why are we looking backwards? We call it the counting of the Omer, the place we left. Instead of counting the days that we're looking forward to passing, we count the days that have gone by. What is the meaning of this? I'll add one more question because I know that Chicago Jews are America's intellectual black belts. And I'm sure you'd like some homework to think about. So here's a challenging question that we won't have time to answer this evening. But I believe if you understand tonight's subject deeply, you can also have an access to this question. Just for you to think about. Do you know that the counting of the Omer is a marking of time? But amazingly, the Ramban says that it's not a time-bound mitzvah. You know, there are two types of positive mitzvahs in the Torah. There are time-bound mitzvahs, what we call mitzvahs esei shehazman groma, positive mitzvahs that time causes, and there are mitzvahs that are not time-caused. Giving charity, for example, is not governed by time. When the need arises, you have to give charity. But things that are time-bound, wearing tzitzis, for example, which are done in the daytime, or tefillin, which is daytime, things that are occasioned by date or time, so those are called time-bound mitzvahs. In fact, women are exempt from those. Women do not need to be locked into a time sequence like men do. They really resonate with time in a very deep way. Amazingly, the Ramban writes that the mitzvah of counting the Omer is not a time-bound mitzvah. That is very strange. If there's one mitzvah in the Torah that is only time, it's a counting of the days. It takes place between one time and another. It must be done at a certain time. He holds this as not a time-occasion mitzvah. That's some homework to think about. But let's take the questions that we began with and try to understand. And here's the key. We are counting days to reach something that goes beyond days. If there's one way to get in touch with a spiritual experience in the world, it is only in the world. It's an amazing message, this, and an amazing idea. We're seeking something that transcends. We want to make connection with a higher world. How do you do that? The answer is you cannot. You can't leap into another dimension. All you can ever do is put the pieces together correctly, the finite pieces, each one seemingly trivial. And if that's done correctly, something happens, something manifests that transcends the parts. In English, you call this something where the sum is greater than the parts. There's a total here that transcends the parts. You know, to illustrate this, I would say, perhaps the ideal illustration would be music. No accident, by the way, that we count 7 days of seven weeks of 7 days. The commonly used musical scale that we use in Western music is a seven-note scale. And music works like this. Music consists of notes, individual notes, each of which is meaningless. And somehow when they're put together, something, the scientific language is, emerges. There's an emergent phenomenon called music. And the amazing thing about music is that you cannot play the music, you can only play the notes. But you don't mean the notes, what you mean is the music. But you can't do that. What comprises a great piece of music? It's one note after another after another. Each note is ridiculously trivial. In fact, if you separate them, it's a plink and a plink and a plonk and a plink. That's not music. But when you put those together correctly, something emerges called music, which you cannot do other than playing the individual notes. All spiritual experience in the world is like that. If there's any way to get from this world to something that transcends it, it is only by taking the steps in this world. A great poem consists of one word after another. Each word is meaningless and irrelevant on its own. Somehow you put them together and something emerges. That is totality. It begins to sing. A love relationship is like that. Two friends who love each other dearly. Or a marriage built over decades. Something emerges, ought to emerge, which is larger than the sum of the parts. But when you break it down, what built that? It was one more mundane activity and another one. One more smile, one more kind act, one more act of consideration. And those things strung together long enough and consistently and faithfully enough, something emerges that is far larger than the sum of the parts. One's Torah learning should be that way. What is a person of great wisdom in Torah? Clearly people like this have a transcendent ability. There's a certain insight, there's a certain resonance. And what does it comprise? It's one understanding after another, one more page of Talmud, another back-breaking or mind-breaking exercise of perception. And after years and years of doing that, there's a certain transcendent perception that emerges. Lahavdil, professionals are like that. A person of great experience, I can speak from my own experience of spending years in the world of medicine. When you see people who are great in that field, whether it's in surgery or any area of expertise, you see that there's something, there's a sensitivity, there's ability that transcends one's own capacity to explain. But it's a function of year after year after year of experience. You know, from the sublime to the ridiculous. When you want to build muscle, I'm sure you don't spend your time here in Chicago spending hours in the gym every day trying to approximate the good looks of an orangutan. But, you know, there are people who do that. So you go and you spend hours and hours. You come home, you measure your biceps, you know, you won't find a difference. A week later, also not. A month later, also not. But month after month, eventually, something starts to emerge. All meaningful experience in the world is like that. And that's a basis of Torah. The meaning of counting the Omer is that to reach Shavuos, which is Torah, which is out of this world, you can only do it through this world. It's what, the reason we count forwards and not backwards is because you cannot do Torah. You can't define that destination and do it. All you can do is put one brick after another. We count one day, that's secure. Let's put the next day, we count that one. When you put all the steps of the journey together, the destination arrives. The reason we call it counting the Omer, by the way, the word Omer means to pile up. That's what Omer means. Ma'amer means to put another piece together, another piece, until finally the totality. When you build a building, you can't produce the building. You can only put the bricks together. But if you put each brick in its correct place, correctly disposed and loyally placed, with great care and precision, eventually something emerges that is far more beautiful and indescribably moves beyond each of the parts. Counting the Omer teaches that if you want to reach a thing called Torah, which is a relationship with a transcendent world, you can't leap into that. All you can do is put the pieces in place. There's one more day of work and another day of work and another. There's one more note in the symphony and another one with an ear to the music. And something emerges that is far greater than the sum of the parts. And therefore, counting the Omer is exactly that. We don't count the last day. The reason we don't count the first day is because that happens automatically. Pesach is a leap. Pesach means to leap over. It's a day of spiritual gift. No work needs to be done. It's a tremendous inspiration. It's the child learning Torah before he's cruelly taken away. And then he's born in the world, and the message is, you get the message, you like it, you do it yourself. And then you walk through the desert of life's experience. Each painful step acquired one at a time through the burning heat of the desert. But each of those steps placed correctly, you reach something that transcends. So that we don't count the first day. You have to be inspired. It comes from someplace else. The child doesn't do that work himself. He's taught the whole Torah for free. But the process begins the step after that. And step after step. And the reason we don't count the last day is because the 50th day is not one more step. The 50th day is something that far transcends. The way we count the 50th is by not giving it a number. When we've counted the 49, when you play the notes, the music happens. You don't do that. By the way, the whole Torah is like that. You know, the Torah says when a person transgresses certain prohibitions, there are lashes that need to be given. And the language in the Torah is arba'im yakenu, lash him 40 times. The Talmud says, yeah, it means 39. You know, it says 40. 40 does not mean 39. But it's a consistent theme in Torah. When you put the 39 pieces together, the effect of a 40th emerges. And therefore, indeed, you have done the 40. Torah is something that transcends the world. No human being can comprehend that. Nobody can move into that. The only way you can get there is by one more brick and another brick, one more day's counting and another day's counting. The meaning is to arrive at something that transcends the details. And it's a great tragedy for a person who lives in the world, putting the pieces together correctly and nothing emerges from that. Right? Let's go back to the questions we began with. You know, the people of stone, they were brutal, immoral. But when the Navi, when the prophet targets the reason for their destruction, he says, because the world received nothing from you. No charity means that there was no production, nothing emerged. Nothing resonated. You lived a life in which all the details were put in place and nothing came from you. You know, I would say if you want an analogy, there's following the rules of the road, and there's, let's say you hire a truck driver. You have a big load of goods to take down to, I don't know, Dallas. So you hire this driver and you say to him, listen, I want you to get it right. This is a very important delivery. Take this truck, drive it down to Dallas, and get it right. No speeding tickets. Don't get stopped. Make sure the tire pressure's good, the engine, the oil. I want you to get the job right. He says, boss, no problem. Drives down to Dallas. 3 days later, comes back. You say to him, how did it go? He says, amazing. Wasn't stopped. Made excellent time. Got there. No problems. You say, did you deliver the goods? Oh, he says, I forgot. You know? You can be getting all the details right. If you're a religious Jew, you can fulfill every detail and have nothing significant emerge. You can be driving down the road, watching all the road signs and obeying all the rules of the road, and you might be on the wrong road or going south instead of north. There's something that transcends the parts. Something needs to emerge from this. Why were the people of Sodom, why were they targeted as people who were needed to be destroyed because there was no production, nothing that emerged? You know, let's say you hire someone to work in your home. You hire a lady, she's going to be a maid in your house and she's going to help you. So you hire her. She comes in the morning, she does a good day's work. 3 or 4 days later, you notice some things are missing. Some cash, a pair of socks, some small items are missing. She's doing a great job, but stuff's missing. How do you handle that? I don't know, it depends. Maybe you confront her, maybe you make her pay, maybe you lock up stuff so you don't tempt her. But how about this? You hire a lady to work in your home. She arrives at 8 o'clock in the morning and sits on a chair in the living room and does not move till 5. 5 o'clock, she gets up and leaves. Next day, bang on time, 8 o'clock, she arrives, sits down, doesn't move till 5 and leaves. She doesn't take anything. Nothing missing. What do you do in such a case? You fire. Why? She's not doing any damage, but nothing's happening. The job's not being done. When the people of stone were immoral and brutal, that could be handled. It could be discussed. But when the world receives nothing from them, when there's details and process happening and nothing emerges, there's no reason to be existing in the world. And that's a consistent theme. You know, that third angel, what does he come to see? The first angel adds up all your mitzvahs. Excellent. The second, all your transgressions. They have to be dealt with. And you make an accounting. But there's something else. There's a third issue. And that is, who are you? You know, the way to understand this is when Hillel couldn't afford a few pennies to study Torah and he lay on the skylight. Why? Because when you're exempt and you've got a good reason. I didn't study today because I always didn't have the money. That's fine. Absolutely. No claims against you. But you learned nothing. You know, imagine you take a study course. 1 year course, you have to attend weekly lectures. And the rule is that if you don't attend the lectures, you need to bring a doctor's letter. So the first week you have a broken ankle, you bring a letter. The next week you got bad flu, you bring a letter again. The entire year goes by, you never attend any of the lectures. And for each of them, you got a valid excuse. What happens at the end? There's no claims against you. You fulfill the letter of the law. But you know nothing. The reason that he was prepared to lie in the skylight wasn't because he was worried about the infraction of whether you're exempt or not exempt. He was clearly exempt. But if you go along with the exemptions, and you hand in your notice at the end, I was exempt, but who are you? There are two accountings that are made of a lifetime. When a person leaves this world, there's a question they ask you. Why didn't you learn more Torah? So you have a good answer to that. You'll say, no, I was too poor, I was too rich. That's fine. But then there's another accounting. What have you become? Did music emerge? This is a serious message. Perhaps the most serious message. And therefore, I think what we can take from the Omer, we can take something moving forward, want to move towards Shavuos, make this year perhaps different than before. I think the question to ask really is, fulfilling details, moving along the road, observing the rules of the road. We're doing that. And of course, one can always do it better. Avoiding the transgressions and not doing damage in the world, of course. But in all facets of life, a question that is perhaps even more significant that has to be asked, and that is when all these pieces are being put in place, you're worrying about each brick, you're worrying about each note in the musical score, you're worried about each action that you do within your marriage, your child raising, your Torah learning, your building of self, family, community. Of course the details need to be there. But if you don't have an ear for the music, it's a bizarre activity. A person is playing plinks and plinks and plonks and plonks, and he's getting each of them right, and no music is being heard. Is it life that's passing tragically? And therefore the counting of the Omer is an activity which is really meant to teach not only the meticulous observance of details. Of course it has to be there. And there's no way to get to the transcendence beyond that. You can't build those muscles without day after day of work. And you can't build the muscle of the mind without the minutiae of the effort that needs to be made. But if there's one larger message that needs to emerge from the counting of the Omer, it's building that pile that is significant, so significant that when the pieces are put together, something emerges that's greater than the sum of the parts, and then all the notes have been played correctly in one's own inner development, in one's Torah learning, in one's marriage, in one's family building, that something happens that is not simply a set of notes, but it's a great symphony where the music can be heard. Thank you.